the leaders of the party, and there was one little amendment, except in extenuating circumstances. And most of the money had been raised on Long Island. We had a huge meeting at Hofstra University, tied up traffic and everything, raised $50,000 or $60,000. I mean, unheard of sums at that particular time. I mean, most assemblies and Senate races were run for $1,000 or $2,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So, Assembly District Number One. Now, Lynn Costello gets up and says, "This is an extraordinary circumstance, and you know, we should give money to this candidate." And I just want to say to the upstate people, if you support us on this, we'll support you on any extenuating circumstances that you have. And all the money was spent. We didn't have any money to give to Steingut. So it took us a long time to repair that. What a waste. We had television ads on Long Island. Before that, there was nothing more than signs on the side of the road. We had guys with television ads that were going to Connecticut and New Jersey, you know, running for the assembly in New York. And Maggiato said he spent $75,000 on Jones's race. Now, the next election is for governor.
Right.
And it's against Malcolm Wilson, who I guess made Rockefeller. He drove Rockefeller around the state and made Rockefeller the winner, you know, and then served as a loyal lieutenant governor all the years, and Rockefeller leaves to go there. Did you ever read Rockefeller's book, I Never Wanted to Be Vice President of Anything?
No, I haven't read it now.
It's a good book.
Okay.
So Wilson, of course, is an extreme conservative, but Wilson was responsible for teachers getting Social Security coverage in New York State. He delivered that through the Senate. And Maggiato calls us down and says to me, they come in the room, don't listen to anything he says. I will be right there next to him, and teachers will get whatever they want. I said, okay. So Malcolm Wilson was walking in the room and goes, Hobart, you are going to help me put these outlawed teachers in jail that go out on strike. And Maggiato says, Tom, remember what I told you? Tom, remember what I told you?
Yeah, right.
So we meet with Wilson, and afterwards I said to Joe, he's going to say that on the campaign trail. I says, I know, Tom. I tried to tell him not to say that. Before that, we had gone to the first convention in Montreal, and Wilson had come up, and he'd done this to me once before about outlaw teachers. Mm-hmm. He had come in, he flew up to Montreal, and he came in, and he said the same thing to me, and I said, Governor, with all due respect, let me tell a delegate you're sick. You can't say that to our delegates. So Dan Sanders said to me, look, go down and start the convention. Let me work with him for a while. And Maggiato was there at that time, and they worked together. And Wilson came down, and Sanders said to me, it's fixed. And Wilson got up, and he said, just had an interesting meeting with your officers. They thanked me for coming to Montreal. I just want you to know, if you had gone to Saskatchewan, I would have come to your convention. And another thing, there was a bill that was rushed through the two houses, which was called the Jerebeck Bill. So 72 bills, very conservative. You know what they were. One of them was moved the probationary period to 5 years. The law used to say probationary period shall be from 3 to 5 years. It took out from 3 to. So it said probationary period shall be 5 years. It was the third year that law had been in effect. So Wilson stands up there and says, and another thing, I was looking at this law. It says it takes 5 years for a superintendent to decide whether a teacher is good or not. Let me tell you,
If any superintendent can't decide whether a teacher is good after 3 years, the superintendent we should get rid of, not the teacher. So like that, brings down the house. And then another thing is the legislative hearing. And there was no finality to the Taylor law. It said that if the two sides did not come together, that governmental body should meet and impose a contract. So in a school district, the board hires the administrative staff. They negotiate the contract. If you can't come to an agreement, the board decides which side is best. So we would be killed on it. So he said, another thing, this legislative hearing. Whoever heard of anything so unfair? We're getting rid of that. And finally, the schools are underfunded. We're going to have a 15% increase in state aid. We never got more than a 4 or 5% increase ever, you know, 15%. So delegates are flying high. You know, here a governor come and say this. Now we're in the gubernatorial race. We got Wilson. He's just said that at the convention. The Democrats nominate Howard Sandings. So Al says, this is the bastard that broke the garbage strike in New York City. So he said, we can't go with him. I said, well, who are we going to go with? You can't go with Wilson. We don't have anybody. He goes, well, there's this guy, this Congressman Hugh Carey. He said, maybe we can go with him. So we go down, we meet with Carey, and Carey seems like a good guy. He said, and we don't like Samuels, and we don't like Wilson. It seems like better you lose than you support one of these guys. So we go with that. The chairman of the State Democratic Party at that time was Joe Crangle, who was the Buffalo County chairman for a long time. So I get a call from Joe, and he says he's got the convention in Niagara Falls. And he says, look, Tom, if you'll go with Samuels, we'll assure you're going to get what you want. Now, I've been hearing this now from everybody. I heard this from Maggiato, from Wilson, from everybody. And I'll also make John LaFaults the lieutenant governor. So what is the lieutenant governor do? Hey, important job. I become governor someday. Well, that isn't enough. We're going to go with this guy, Hugh Carey. He says, you don't have a chance. You're going to get laughed out. So Carey beat Samuels in the primary by less votes than we got members in the state.
There you go.
And goes on to beat Wilson. And, you know, we're made as an organization. You know, everybody says, well, in fact, a guy that ran for Attorney General Oliver Capel. Mm-hmm. He was appointed and then he ran and he got beat by Spitzer in the primary. That said to me, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. My whole political life, whoever the teachers endorses wins. So those were those things. Whether we were the sole reason or not, we got credit for each one of those. Yeah. And that really, you know, moved us along. And everybody thought that we were invincible, that our endorsement was really important. And we did some good things on a local level, too. I mean, we supported a lot of Republicans. We knew that we had a lot of Republican members upstate, so especially in the Senate. You know, I used to say Steingut used to always say, there's no such thing as a one-house bill, no such thing as a one-house law. Mm-hmm. And,
you want some cashews or something?
Nuts, I know I got it, so.
We support a lot of Republicans in the Senate. This year we're going to fight hard for Joe Bruno because, you know, I would rather not have all one party in government. I've been around long enough that Rockefeller had two houses of Republicans. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't get a meeting in the Senate or the Assembly. They'd say to us, why bother? The governor's not in town. You know, it just makes the governor super powerful in the state. So it's not in our interest to do it. But because we've done this, we can go and I can show you places where we've had Republicans calling for Democrats, Democrats calling for Republicans.
Bruno will stand up at any meeting you want to stand up and say, you know, the teachers are my best friends. And sometimes it gets antsy. We don't support anybody, almost never support anybody in a primary for the Senate or the Assembly. We say, you know, that's up to the party to decide who it is. We then pick the person who is most on our side. And the other thing was that we got way out ahead of the boards of education on contract negotiations. You know, the boards used to send the superintendent in to negotiate their contracts, and you know, we had a master contract that was pretty good. That Buffalo contract, Kay Schiller negotiated for us. I mean, when we won that collective bargaining election, some guy said to me in a bar while we were celebrating, "What do we do now?" I said, "Jesus, I don't know what we do now." And so the association sent in Kay Schiller, and they did a contract for Buffalo, and we used that contract all across the state, you know. And
what was so unique about the contract?
Oh, it covered so many different areas. You know, it's not a normal labor contract that is vacation, leaves, and pay. I know this is textbooks, and I mean, you know, we have 30 and 40-page contracts that cover every aspect of Board of Education's policy making. And so that was NYSA. Now, NYSA got into the AFT. Right after the merger, Al said we should sit down with Dave Selden and I don't know what John Schmidt's title was. He was the chief organizer.
Assistant to the president, chief organizer.
Yeah. And he said we worked out with Dave, you know, how we would come in as an organization, because at that point, I don't remember the numbers, but let me make up numbers. AFT had about 215,000 members, and we had 214,000.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, let me cut it down. The UFT was in there, so the AFT had 200,000, and we had 200,000 with the AFT, and 50,000 were from the AFT that was there. So we were coming to the convention with a huge, huge load. And so he worked out with Dave how he would do it, and that's how the 25 cents per member per month going to state federations came about. You know, that was money they were sending back to us to make up for the difference between the $18
okay.
AFT dues and $25 NEA dues. And so we started. Al brought us to the Minnesota St. Paul convention.
This is your first AFT convention.
Yeah, okay. We had the vote. AFT voted at that convention. We had the vote in June to accept the merger, and in July we went to the AFT convention, and so Al says it's very important that you speak on the merger. So we had a plane going back to New York. We had something going on in New York. Al says, "Oh, you got to speak at the convention." So, all right. So we watched the convention on St. Ed and Tony, because we were the only delegates from the NYSTA side that were there. I said, you know, this is totally different from what we...
Here's some clusters, Tim. These are your sugar-free ones. Yeah. You might want something, you know.
Thanks.
Do
you want me to open the doors and hide?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's getting warmer here now.
Yeah, you turn your fan on, too?
Sure, I'll do that for you.
You know, it's a real battle for the Association, then there was etiquette.
Right.
You say, excuse me, well, you were the first one for me, you know.
You're slugging it out to get to the microphone.
So I'm watching this, you know, clear the microphone, you're charging it. So if something happens, it doesn't come up when it's supposed to come up, it's delayed for a while. So.
Oh.
Eddie and Tony said, you know, we're going to miss our plane. You got to be first at the microphone. We're going to miss our plane. So there was a guy, Herrick Roth, who was the president from Colorado.
Yeah.
He was also president of the AFL-CIO in Colorado. who was for McGovern too. You know, Meany had the big convention to beat him down, but. So he's across the aisle from me. He's opposed to the merger. And so there's a false start. He gets the microphone first. But it's a false start. Selden says, clear the microphones every single time. And I look and I say, okay. He's got it. You know, he's closer to the microphone than I am. You know, he's going to get it. So I got to catch that plane. So I figured, but I think I can rip that tape off the floor. I can move the microphone. So he's up, I'm up. I get the tape off the microphone, put it in front of me. It's no longer in front of him, it's in front of me. Now, he objects. He objects, he says, that, now you moved the microphone! Mr. Chairman, I don't know what he's talking about. I'm in front of the microphone. You know, I'm first here. So anyway, Selden rolls and I'm the first one to my fly, I get my pitch and I got it. Now the UFT is going crazy on this. You know, Al says, you know, you really impressed my guys at the UFT. To know how to fight and win.
Yeah, right.
So
no upstate softy there, huh? Yeah.
But we saw Dave perform. And also, Dave was beyond his time. He really wasn't acting in the interest of the members. He had his own agenda. The time before the convention, I was not at New Orleans then. No, I guess it was one before that. It was a two-year term. McElroy was on the opposite side of Selden. McElroy talks about how he tried to get Al to run. Al wouldn't run.
Yeah. This is 73. Two.
It's 72.
Okay.
The convention I'm talking about is 70. When the guy from the staff ran against
Nielsen. Yeah.
They said that Dave grew a beard and went on a sailing trip around Cape of Good Hope or something like that. And Al did all the campaigning. So it was pretty much decided by 74 that we would run Al. Our slogan was AFT wants what New York has. And and we won. One big. Dave got about 30% of the vote. No, he only got 10%. Dave didn't get very much of the vote.
No.
Al was overwhelmed. And Al had submitted a constitutional amendment to increase the executive council by 10. So 8 New Yorkers went on. Tony Cortese, I, Sandy, Paul Cole, I don't remember the whole list of people. You know, a lot of people went on from New York.
Yeah.
It was a
Velma Hill was on it. Velma Hill?
Yeah, Velma Hill was on it. Jules Cloggin went back on. Jules got knocked off. Walter Tice went on in 70, Jules got knocked off in 70, and Jules went back on. And so we started, you know, a new operation. That was a terrible convention because we went to the caucus meeting after Al's election, and the whole convention is euphoric. You know, AFT is on the move, you know, we got a new leader, we're going everywhere. Going to the caucus, elect the caucus officers, and Philadelphia walks out. No minorities on the slate. John Ryan leads the charge. Frank Sullivan is president, but there's really a three-member group that runs it. Sonny something. Sonny's name was a woman. And John Ryan and Frank Sullivan. And Ryan leads them out. Now, this has huge ramifications because, in order to get them back, we expand the executive committee of the caucus. Uh, And we put everybody that's a worker of the caucus on the executive board. That's a mimeograph machine operator. And Ryan outmaneuvers us. He gets all those positions. We're either Philadelphia or Delaware, and Philadelphia owns Delaware. So 2 years later, Al wants Al Fondi on the executive committee. We get beat, and Ryan goes on the executive committee instead of Fondi. And Al's comment was, well, we're going to turn this around. The guy that operates a mimeograph machine just outvoted Hobart. And there were big changes that were made in the caucus after that. But the
did this also involve Bill Simonson?
Simon. It might have been Sonny Simonson. I don't know what Sonny's name was. Bill Simon was in 70 when he was elected to the executive council. And Al figured out, George Altamari, I guess, was the one that figured out the vote. And that Simonson didn't deliver his delegation to vote for Cloggy. But that was 70. And it might have been by 74 that we let Simon back on, you know. We got back with him. He could be opposed to secret. He could be in favor of secret ballot, but, you know, he'd support the caucus in all other aspects.
Okay. So you're at NEA, you're going to NEA, RA, and AFT conventions.
NEA, and yes, and we got an organization called the National Council for Teacher Unity. NEA is big on what they call sub-governance groups.
Okay.
Sub-governance groups are like the National Council of Urban Education Associations, NCUEA, National Council of State Education Organization, National Council on Human Rights. So I was a member of all those things. So I went to a lot of conventions. Had bags, woke up. And so we started National Council for Teacher Unity. We had to take our merger to the NEA convention in 72 and have it approved. And it was approved. It was approved well. I don't want to say substantially. It was approved well. There wasn't any doubt on it. You know, there were 5,000 votes. There was 3,000, 2,000, something. So the next year, we ran Tony Cortese for president of the NEA. Her campaign slogan was a very interdependent organization. As the NEA said, it was independent of the AFL-CIO.
Okay.
So we were very interdependent. And the NEA was big on quotas. And she was the first Yugoslav candidate for NEA president. So at one of these subgroups, we ran a huge party. We spent way too much money, $10,000. I'd never signed a voucher for $10,000 for anything other than for attorneys, you know. But we had this at the Playboy Club in Chicago, which I always remind her of. She didn't have any qualms about going to the Playboy Club when we had this party. And we thought we were going to make real progress. There were three candidates. There was Jim Gunnison from California and Jim Harris from Iowa. And Tony came in third, but she had less votes than we'd gotten for the merger, approval of the merger the year before. So we decided to lay low for the convention in, that must have been 74 that Tony ran, so 75 we laid low. No, it must have been 73 that Tony ran, 74 we laid low, 75. '75, I ran for the executive committee, and I got 889 votes, which was far less than Tony had gotten for president. Another candidate from New York ran and got more votes than I got. Mm-hmm. But there were 789 delegates from New York. Now, I know I didn't get all the New York votes, but I didn't get this guy's vote that also ran against me.
Yeah.
But the numbers were the same. So the buzz in the hall was that, Shanker controls absolutely, or Hobart controls absolutely as controlled by Shanker. It was the first days of cellular phones. They came in suitcases.
Yeah.
Long antennas. So Dean Strife had a cellular phone. He had said to me, can we get a phone? I said, sure. And every meeting he'd come to, he'd open up his briefcase, and up would go the antenna. This was about a 20-foot antenna, we'd go way up. And so everybody would heckle us on this. So the vote in the convention comes down, and there's a tie between Ryer and Harris. Harris is incumbent. Now, during the campaign, we were very close to Ryer's campaign manager, Ron DiOrio from Rhode Island, a friend of Eddie's. And Roberta Hickman was from Texas. Her campaign manager, Joe Pistoris, I think his name was, from Michigan. And DiOrio would say, as we run into him, get away from me, we don't want to be tainted by the New York people, we're going to win this election because of you. So what does that mean? No? You'll find out. But Joe Pistoris said to us, look, it's already been decided with any executive committee that you're going to be thrown out. I'm going to throw you out for not having minority quotas, mm-hmm. and not having a secret ballot for election of officers, which are part of the NEA Constitution.
And anything with AFL-CIO was okay with them?
Yeah, that was done.
Angeles already did it, and... Yeah. Yeah, okay.
But they'd approved our merger.
Right.
And these were constitutional.
But you were violating the Constitution. Gotcha.
And we assumed we were going to get thrown out. So we go to Al's favorite restaurant in Los Angeles, Maghreb, I think it was called. It was a...
French restaurant?
No. It was a...
it was before the French.
Persian restaurant or something. It was something. You ate with your hands.
Okay.
And it was a great Bayard Rush story about that. He went over to advise Gandhi on nonviolent demonstrations. So he said, they bring out all the food and everybody's eating, and Byron reaches in to eat, and the room goes quiet. The waitstaff comes running out, takes all the food, all the napkins, everything out. A few weeks later, bring in all new stuff. Byron says, I didn't know what I did, but I knew I did something. He said, I just didn't eat, I just sat there. Afterwards, he says, I said, okay, what'd I do? And the guy says, we eat with our right hand, we wipe our ass with the left hand. But anyway, we go to this restaurant. Dean sits down, he puts down his briefcase, opens it up.
Yeah.
Up goes the antenna, and this place is filled with NEA people. They're all booing us. So now we have a couple of drinks. Pretty soon the phone rings. And the place goes quiet.
Yeah.
And I don't remember Jim Harris's campaign manager, his name, but anyway, Dean says, oh, Mr. whatever the name is, place is quiet. Absolutely, we'd be very happy to come over for a meeting. Yes, sir, see you in about a half hour. And down comes the antenna. We pay the bill, out we go. So Harris has a plan for us. The merger between the NEA and the ATA, the American Teachers Association, the Black Association, grandfathered their constitution. So Harris says, I will consider you part of the ATA merger. So whatever in your constitution is grandfathered. And I'll deliver the entire black vote to you. If you'll deliver your 889 votes to me.
Wow.
And we said yes. But Ryer won.
Yeah.
Ryer got... Harris said that he was sure that we got all the black vote, but it was just that Gummison was the candidate. Roberta Hickman's votes all went to Ryer, and Harris said that he thought it was because people got word that Harris made a deal with us. So, we're off to Hawaii now. We're at the AFT convention in Hawaii.
It was 75,
the,
yeah.
The best attended AFT convention that there ever was. Shanker, master politician, says on the first day, surroundings are awfully nice here, he said. And he said, I'd like to be outside as much as you would be. If you all agree to come on time and work hard, we can finish the convention, finish this five-day convention in 4. Now, I'll tell you, he started at 9 and he ended to whatever that. He also gave us 2 hours for lunch. That was the other part of the deal. And 2 hours for lunch. And I'll tell you, that was the happiest delegation you ever saw. We get back to New York now. It's rubber meets the road time. We know the NEA is going to throw us out. And we're trying to think of how we're going to preserve the organization. We have no idea how much loyalty still remains from the time that people were in the NEA. We think it's not much, because when NYSET had 105,000 members, and there were only 35,000 from the NEA, and we feel some of those have died. Mm-hmm. And but we know that some people who were not members of the NEA then have become involved in the NEA now, so you know, what are we going to do? The attorneys tell us that we are vulnerable because our Constitution requires affiliation with the NEA, and theirs doesn't require them to affiliate us. So they can pick the time to throw us out, and we can only leave during a convention. So we decide to remove the requirement that says the organization shall be affiliated with the AFT and the NEA. So we submit a resolution that takes out and the NEA. And we have no intention of leaving the NEA. We're just, you know, we're just getting set for this fight. And we thought, you know, we could always fall back on the Harris idea. You know, the NEA could guarantee us, or grandfather us under the ATA, and you know, we could stay in, and nobody stood. So we think we're gonna come out of this okay. Now, we notice that there's a group of people that are going around the state campaigning for the NEA. We only had one negative vote on the executive committee. It was Tom Pisa from Buffalo.
You're a local.
I'm a local. Pisa was mad at me. He felt I was disloyal. In the BTF Constitution, I'd never taken out the clause for the immediate past president. The guy that I replaced pleaded with me not to take it out. He wanted to serve one more year as immediate past president, so I didn't. But when I became immediate past president, I kept telling the executive committee that they should eliminate it, that it was a bad position. I said, I'll tell you, my philosophy is as long as I'm here, I'm here to support the president, therefore I'm not an independent voice. And if it's somebody else, I wouldn't want somebody who's opposing the president here. And as far as organizational history, call me on the phone, I'll tell you anything you want to know. Pisa said I was disloyal, and you know, I tried to find out if it was because he wouldn't be immediate past president or what, but anyway, I got it out. And he also told me that Buffalo, by virtue of its size, should be as important in New York State as the UFT, and really the pecking order was the UFT, NYSET, then Buffalo. Well, I really can't, you know, I don't think everybody would agree with you, but the UFT is the highest in the order in the state. Al wouldn't agree with you. You know, what are we taking away from you? Well, it makes you more prominent in the state than it makes me. So we had that rub that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
There also was a very strong, the NEA has been
I told you about sub-governance. They also had the undercurrent cultures that were in there. There was a while that there was a feeling that the NEA was run by the Mormons that were on the staff. Most of the staff, high staff positions, were Mormons in the NEA. And that was a fact. Whether they were running it for the Mormon church or not, I mean, I never had that feeling. You know, we had disagreements, but I never thought that they were Mormon versus non-Mormon disagreement. They also had a very large culture of gays, of which Pisa was a member, and the executive secretary that I hired was also a member of that group. And I thought that that was a great influence on Tom. Tom is openly gay now, so I mean, I don't think it's a betrayal of him to talk about it. I thought that that was one of the reasons that he felt he had to stay with the NEA. So he, we feel, I never could validate this, but from conversations I had with Terry Hernan and with others, Ken Malley, I think the NEA's feeling, now the NEA wanted to do this, you know, but they also were an organization that weighed the consequences. I think Pisa convinced the NEA that they could win in the state. Their theme was that they would have 30,000 members by June and they would have 50,000 members by September. And a number of the staff who left, just a difficult time in my life, I would come in the morning and white envelopes would be on my desk to Tom Hobart, and it would be staff members saying that they'd left to go to the NEA.
So you had a lot of defections?
A lot of defections.
Once or twice a day?
Yeah, 19 or 20 left our staff of 160 or 170. So the operation against us was operated out of Buffalo.
Okay.
Staff members would come into Buffalo, get their assignments, go around the state. And this group, I'm hesitating because I'm trying to think of names. Ed, Brian Bushwilder is one. Ed Robish was another. And Pisa E. Lewin was from Buffalo. They'd go around the state, and we were wondering how they were funding themselves to go around the state. It's expensive. They'd fly. You know, they'd have to have substitutes in their schools. They would eat, host others. I'll tell you how they did it later in the story. We go into the convention, and when the constitutional amendment comes up, there's vigorous debate on it, and it goes to a vote, and by a two-thirds vote, by more than a two-thirds vote, it's easily passes to remove the NEA from the Constitution as an affiliate, as a required affiliate. And a group walks out of a Hilton where we're meeting. They walk down to down to the Sheraton, which is across the street, in a pre-arranged ballroom, and they set up New York Educators Association, New York Education. No, it isn't NEA. Well, I forget.
No, they left out the EA part. Yeah, yeah. They weren't any association with that.
Yeah.
At first.
Yeah, it was New York. Whatever.
I can't remember. They
set it up. They elect Robish as president. And I get a telegram minutes later from Ken Malley from the NEA staff. He's the high-ranking person. I know what his role is. Informing me that the UNISERV money, which was monies that each state got to hire staff, were suspended. And I
So I sent back a telegram saying, well, we're going to suspend sending any of the dues that we owe you. And so they suspended $900,000, and I held on to $6 million. I thought they hadn't thought about the consequences, you know, of this.
Isn't that how much the NEH sued you, though, for?
Well, they sued us for an amount in excess of $10,000, which is the federal requirement in court.
Okay.
But if we added it up from the merger agreement, it appears that it was about $12 million, I think, okay, what it was. Because it was a percentage or something if you didn't stay affiliated for 5 years. Our claim was we didn't disaffiliate.
Right, yeah.
So they
suffer the consequences.
Yes. So we start going to the NEA conventions and we start talking about the $3.15 New York tax on every NEA member, because they're giving New York $5 million to operate with out of NEA funds.
Yeah.
It's a tax. So after 2 or 3 years, we stopped going to the NEA convention because we've heard from enough NEA delegates that said, good, you know, we pay twice that much. So I said, oh, this isn't working, so I'm going to cut this out. So they never got to 50,000. It took them a long time to get to 30,000. And it wasn't until they started organizing paraprofessionals that they crossed 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they're up to about 40,000 now that they say they're bringing into NEA New York or into NYSEN, so we'll see how much they bring in. So it was broken up. It wasn't broken up. We said that there was no breaking up of the merger. All the leaders of both sides were still intact, and the preponderance of the membership was still intact. So the merger never was broken up. We remained merged in New York. We just didn't send any dues money to the NEA. Which I used to always have to try to not be pushy with, but remind Minnesota and Montana and Florida. You know, we're still merged, too. But the suit came about, and as I said, federal requirements for the suits, an amount in excess of $10,000. And if we had a merger agreement, I'd go through and show you how it came out. But I think it comes down to $10 or $12 million was the indemnity for breaking the merger. So we paid about $500,000 to the Shea and Gardner law firm to defend us on this. They are corporate contract people. And a lot of discovery. I went down to testify so often. We always had attorneys up in our office going through our files. But through discovery, we got the minutes of the NEA executive committee. Now, the board of directors never got the minutes of the executive committee. The board of directors was not allowed to know what the salaries of the executive secretary or the top staff were. That was the executive committee decided all that. Never was passed on or ratified by the board or anything. You know, whatever the executive committee did was sealed.
Mm-hmm.
So we got their minutes. And in, I think, 1973, the NEA executive committee began by allocating $50,000 to the New York project to run a political campaign against us. It was specifically said to pay for substitutes, hotel rooms, dinners, and airfare, or travel expenses, you know. So that's where they were getting their money. One other thing I should tell you. In the fall of 74, the Orchard Park teachers went out on strike. And I arranged for both Al and John Ryer to come to New York to talk to the Orchard Park teachers. Bitter, bitter strike. And on the way back to the airport, I was driving Al and John. New York was going through the crisis that had... you know, we were about to go bankrupt in New York City. And I told Ryer that, you know, we didn't call on the NEA for very much. And I know that he was very sensitive about that, but we were going to call upon him. I needed an economic plan that would challenge Kerry's economic plan, that would preserve the schools in the state. And I was asking him to put together a team of economists that would come up with a plan for us that we could promote. And he said he would think about it. But came back to me, we met with him in New York City, Dan Sanders, Tony Cortese, and I. Was his NEA New York project. And I don't remember the specifics of it, but it was like they were going to send 500,000 pieces of mail directly to New York members. They were going to bring 100 activists to Washington to train them in political action. And they were going to do something else, you know, which we read to mean they were going to train people to be our opponents in the next election. They were going to talk to the members directly about dropping the AFT. They said that they didn't get enough publicity and nice publications. And they wanted us to pay for half of it. I said, what are you out of your mind? What do you think? We are stupid? Now, Ryer came to explain that to the ICE board in Syracuse. And he got a very bad reception. He either win and Tom Pisa and a guy from Katona, which is in Westchester County, I can't think of his name, were the only ones who really supported Ryer while he was there. The rest of the board, I mean, just ripped him apart. And so we published the minutes of the meeting in the newspaper, and they shot back that we misrepresented the meeting. I'm going to tell you, we did not. I pulled out all the stuff that Ned Hopkins had put in that I felt was stretching it, stretching the truth. I mean, it was all truth, but I thought, you know, we could go with the bare truth, and, you know, it was a winner for us. We didn't have to defend anything that we put in this. So after this, they called us to Washington. They sent me a letter, said that they would pay full expenses for whoever I wanted to bring so we could talk about the situation that was developing in New York. So Fred Lambert came with us, and Ed and Tony, Dan Sanders, Al and I went. And Fred brought a tape recorder. He said, we're not ever going to take a challenge again that we misrepresented a meeting. So we sat down at the meeting, brought the tape recorder. Fred turned on the tape recorder. Everybody from the NEA side got up and went outside the room. Turned off the tape recorder. They came back in. Turned on the tape recorder. They went back up. Said, well, wait a minute, guys. You said we misrepresented, you know, what went on. You know, we'll give you a copy of the tape. You have a copy of the tape. You have a copy of the tape, you know. You want to have your own tape recorder? Get your own tape recorder. So they would never meet with us. So we walked out of the NEA building, and Al said, well, let's go to the Madison Hotel for lunch. So we went to the Madison Hotel. We spent about 4 hours in the Madison Hotel. We must have paid $200 a piece for lunch back in the 70s. I mean, we had a guy that made a Caesar salad that, you know, did everything except climb in a bowl. I mean, it was magnificent. And I sent in the bill, and they sent back the reimbursement for it. And, you know, I sent a copy of the letter, said they would pay for expenses. They said that they realized their letter had said full expenses, but it was the most expensive lunch that the NEA had ever reimbursed. So we didn't do it to jab them. We just thought it was that we had expended more in flying to our time in flying to Washington than they were than reimbursing us for the time that we had there. So that's how we came to the breakup. After that, it was we just shut them out in the state. They never were appointed to any committees. They got some press coverage, but it was normally in the minor newspapers. They never made much of a splash. And then we started the talks on merger. I think they initiated them. I don't see any reason why I would have initiated them. Greg Nash, Sandy Feldman thought was an exceptional leader. I have great respect for Greg, too. We had started the national merger talks. They had gone sour at one point, and
looked like... Was it over the usual issues, open ballot, closed ballot, affirmative action, and AFL-CIO?
That was more than that. It was they felt obliged to have a balanced negotiating team. Some people that were in favor of mergers, some people that were opposed, some people that were neutral. And then they needed a unanimous decision to do anything. And the people who were opposed to everything. So Keith Geiger might have pushed too hard at the end because, as with most places where there are term limits, the incumbent always says that the person that's about to come on is disloyal. You know, we're not going to do this. So he said Bob Chase was probably going to torpedo this. We had to get it done while he was president. You know, Keith and I were board members together on the NEA board back in the 70s. I knew Keith very well. At the Detroit convention, he came to see us. I jabbed us that he rode in a car with Carter to come down to our convention.
Yeah.
Said, well, it's the least he could do for you.
Yeah.
And so Keith was a good guy, but I don't think Keith had the political ability to move the merger. Remember, Chase started off on the new type of unionism.
Mm-hmm.
So he already had people, you know, upset over something out here. And so then he started on merger. And I think he had more political capital. He certainly moved the process along. The difficulty was that he and his officers never sold the principles of unity. They felt that their role was simply to answer questions. I was a little slow to criticize them, since on the New York merger, we were told we couldn't sell the merger, and we went out to do it. But I don't know if he ever said, well, I signed it.
Yeah, right. So he never concentrated on, like, the Pennsylvanians, the New Jerseys, the Michigans, the real hardcore anti-merger people.
Or the Connecticuts.
He
lost Connecticut. they told us they didn't think they could get the two-thirds vote, but they thought they could get in the low 60s. And obviously they didn't have a good hold on the organization. But during that period of time, Greg Nash was on the negotiating team. Once it started up again, you know, it slowed down and started up again. Sandy was becoming more the leader of the group. She encouraged me with Greg. And, you know, she didn't have to encourage a lot. I mean, we should have, you know, Al's idea, we should have one organization. I, you know, fully embrace, and, you know, bring it about, and bring it about. And so we worked with Greg on it. The problem for us was the staff. The staff had an agreement which said that it was Appendix B, I think, said that if any one of the following items in the opinion of the staff is not properly negotiated, the staff can call in an arbitrator on the single issue of, is the staff happy with the agreement? And I'm paraphrasing somewhat on this, but that's really what it broke down to. They could go to an arbitrator and they could stop the organization from approving a merger with us if they weren't happy with the agreement. And I told Greg he had to get it out. I said, look, this is a strike issue. If you want to merge, you take the strike. We're not going to take the strike after the merger. Now, there's going to be enough turmoil after the merger. We're not going to start off with a staff strike.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you probably don't have to go to a staff strike because the court's going to enjoin us from merging. Because, you know, this arbitration is ironclad. Greg kept saying that the staff had assured him they would not implement. He said, you know, look, I believe. But the board doesn't think that I should believe it. Got to get it out. He then came to me one time, one last attempt, and he said, well, look, I've arranged for you to meet with the president of the staff union. The president of the staff union was Tom Pisa. I said, I have no relationship with your staff union. None at all. There's no reason for me to meet with them. You get it out of the contract. That's what you got to do. So Robin Rappaport got it out. I'm not sure I agreed he got it out, but Dick Iannuzzi said that he was satisfied that it was not going to come up, and so far it hasn't come up, but any staff member. I had asked our attorneys to assure me that it was a union decision and not a member decision. I didn't want the union giving us a guarantee and then any member, you know, invoking it. And about the end of February in 2005, we had a meeting scheduled, and I told Dick Iannuzzi, I said, you know, at some point I've got to move out of this process. And today's a day I really could use for not important stuff, it was packing my stuff to come back to Buffalo. So I said, I think today is a good day for you to continue on without me at the meeting. So we went into the meeting, and I said goodbye to their team, and I left, and then Dick brought the thing to fruition, and it passed both boards, it's passed both delegate bodies, and on September 1st, W1 organization in New York. Dick did a great job.
Yeah. Took a long, long time. We got a full merger.
We didn't give him much. Greg Nash used to say to me, Tom, you got to give me something that I can go back and say we won. And I said, well, you can go back and you can tell your members you won a much improved service program, that they will be welcomed with open arms into our organization, that they're coming into the organization and make the organization far stronger. And tell them all those things. And they said to me at one point, Robin said, well, now what's the name going to be? I said, well, it seems to me that we're in New York. So we have to say New York State. And what we're doing is uniting teachers. So it seems to me the new name should be the New York State United Teachers. NEA-AFT. Now you want to negotiate over whether it should be NEA-AFT or AFT-NEA? No.
Go ahead. Is so, Buffalo going to stay?
Mike Prescott from the Buffalo office talks to people on their executive committee, and they say that the rumor has said that they should be the last one that joins the new organization. We had a long debate about whether NEA New York could bring all its locals, or whether every local has to have a vote. None of the nice locals will have to vote because they voted a constitutional amendment at the convention. Outside of that, there's no change for them. So I believe they've decided that every local has to vote, but that they've done it in the negative, that any local who doesn't vote not to come aboard is considered an affiliate. And so the information we have is that Phil wants to be the last one so he can negotiate the best deal. Now, I don't know what he means. You know, over the years, I've tried to talk to Phil, and he's always said to me, I can't join you because being from New York and the NEA, I can get anything I want. And I've always said to him, well, tell me what you want. Maybe we can give you what you want. You know, maybe we can't, but, you know, tell me what you want. And he goes, well, we don't need anything. So he sent out a letter. He said that the reason that they shouldn't join is that he met me at a rally that we had on May 3rd a couple of years ago. And that when he came up to say hello, that I didn't, to paraphrase, I didn't treat him with respect, and that I blurted out that he was trying to get a $50 million loan from the state and that we would block the loan. And that the reason we were going to do it is because he wasn't paying dues. Well, in that paying dues part, I remember. The way I remember it, it was not a significant discussion. So I didn't. Mm-hmm. That's something I went down and made notes about. But as I remember it, what I said to him was, or he had said, we should work together on some things. And I said, not while you're not paying dues, because we got all the power.